My name's Neville, and just a brief word of introduction. I've been with Baba for many years and recognized Baba with my heart right at the start, but in the intellect there were problems that would recur from time to time in accepting some of the detailed structure of ideas that Baba would have shared with us in Gyan. For example, the cycle, even a clear acceptance with my intellect of the concept of the soul. At times, that would be questionable in my mind, in my intellect, even though, from the beginning, my heart recognized the truth in Baba's children and in this way of life and in what this knowledge did for us in bringing out our truth. But actually, it remains a weakness. There is a need to have really clearly in your intellect a thorough, well-grounded acceptance of the validity of the ideas that Baba shares with us. Because otherwise, when you're up against it, some strong storm comes and you haven't got that absolute solidity to see you through as quickly as you might otherwise have. So I've been very grateful that in the last few years, through some work with scientists, some of the final pieces of the jigsaw have come together for me. And it's a great pleasure to be able to share a few of these points with you this morning, because I know that sometimes some other BKs also find that when they hear that science is, in some respects, and it's really only quite marginal in a way, but in some respects groping its way towards understanding this very different story, this very different paradigm that Baba works with, that they can find that very helpful. Of course, it's not necessary. The daddies, the army of BKs in India and elsewhere, the great majority have, it's the part that has unfolded for them. The recognition has come sometimes instantly within the intellect. Yes, this is what I was looking for. This is the last piece of the jigsaw when they hear Gyan. But perhaps for some of us who have put a lot of faith in science, it can be a bit more difficult to bring the intellect round in that way. Certainly for me, from the age of about 12, I more or less turned my back on the spiritual dimension. I think probably as a child I was really rather open, but somehow I couldn't seem to get answers to questions that I raised of the local vicar at church and that sort of thing when I was about 12. And also, I think I had something of the feeling that in order to connect with this world, I needed to make my focus a bit more worldly, a bit more materialistic, just to make a proper go of life. And so, gradually, in my teens and 20s, I moved more and more into putting my faith in the scientific approach to the world as being the best for giving us good, solid information about the way things were. And I had quite a distaste for religion when I saw the negative side of religion, where it would have given rise to conflict because of fundamentalist stances. We've got the truth. No, we've got the truth. Okay, we'll shoot you. No, we're going to shoot you. So obviously neither side having the truth in behavior like that. But I had that kind of distaste and felt that science's methods of objectivity, of careful repetition, of getting evidence to support the conclusions was really helpful to humanity, and that that kind of information properly obtained like that might help us to move towards a better future. Little did I know that actually, by focusing so intensely on the material realm, science has missed some very important parts of the picture out. You'll be hearing later from Stella, who is a real scientist, in the sense that she had, actually against her will, but she had studied science, she'd become a scientist, become a world-class scientist in her area. And whereas for myself, it was more at a kind of philosophical level that I embraced science, almost like a science baggart. And at the same time, I did start in my work as a journalist specializing in science and medicine. So although I wasn't trained as a scientist, I had a lot of acquaintance with science. I worked for something like more than 20 years actually specializing in science and medicine out of a total of about 30 years in the newspaper business. So that does form a part of my background. I feel very grateful to it in a way now, because actually, first of all, it was medicine and studying some of the findings of medical scientists on better ways of treating common and chronic problems like raised blood pressure and raised blood cholesterol and other stress-related illnesses. It was from medical scientists that I first learned about the value of meditation. And that opened a door after what was really a kind of visionary experience going back some 22, 23 years, that opened my mind to realize that I must look more deeply into these other dimensions of reality. But more recently, I helped with the organizing of a number of conferences on science and consciousness, where, particularly in the last of these events, the BKs, as one of the sponsors of these conferences, had brought together a number of scientists who are working with what is called a consciousness-based paradigm, which turns on its head the basic materialistic outlook which most scientists embrace. And I was very grateful to learn about this, because this was in fact one of the pieces of the jigsaw that finally made it easier for me to know from very deep inside that, yes, you know, these weren't just ideas that worked in a practical way, but they were ideas that could have the support of people who are studying the world, using their reason to assess things. And it wasn't a question of abandoning one's reason to embrace the ideas that Baba had taught me. I mean, nothing was in fact going to change me on this path, because I've been through many challenges and ups and downs, many storms from mire and from overcoming old vices in the course of my journey. And I think Baba planted a very strong seed of understanding of an experiential kind within me right at the start that was going to see me through. So this is like cream on the cake for me to have found that now there is, science is actually at certain frontiers moving towards an understanding which underpins rather than contradicts Gyan. And it's some aspects of this that I'd like to share with you. I'd also like to mention, perhaps first, I think, some findings that don't really challenge the scientific worldview, but which also give very strong support for, in a practical way, for the things that we do within Gyan. Here, and I'll begin with this because it's a little bit more tangible in a sense than the more theoretical stuff, although in a sense less exciting because we know it already. So you know it already anyway because you have Gyan, but even common sense confirms the findings that scientists are giving us now from the area of neuroscience. We did a program in Oxford some months back, which was called Through the Brain Barrier. And it brought together a brain scientist who heads a 100-strong group of scientists in Oxford, who, and elsewhere actually, called the Oxford Centre for Cognitive Neuroscience. And this professor has a very strong materialistic outlook on the world, but he's also someone who is not a science fundamentalist. He's not someone who will support what science says today at the expense of, in a fundamentalist and unthinking way, as some scientists do. Instead, he remains very open and clear about the areas of understanding that science still needs to move towards. For example, he is very clear that neuroscience, which is the science of the brain, has made some enormous advances in understanding our mental function. But he will also state very clearly that there is a mystery at the heart of it all, a mystery which he thinks with more and more research into how the brain works will eventually be answered by science. But he admits that that's just a faith on his part, because he has faith in science. But at present, there is this huge mystery remains, and the mystery really is to do with the self, and who is the organizing, the perceiving self that experiences this world, that perceives the color red, that has a sense of purpose, that loves, that motivates. What is this entity that we call the self? Of course, Baba has given us some very clear answers on this, of a non-materialistic kind. So the scientists are searching, and they admit that they're far from a solution on that problem, but they have come up with some interesting things from their study of the brain. They've got tools now with which they can track in quite precise detail what is going on inside the brain as we do various functions. So, for example, they can have you wired up in certain ways where they can see that when you're doing a mathematical problem, a certain group of neurons, the nerve cells in the brain, will be more active. When you have certain feelings, there will be groups of neurons that are more active. Everything that we do is reflected in neuronal activity. The brain has something like 100 billion, that's 1,000 million neurons, these nerve cells. It's a phenomenal number. And each one of those 100 billion neurons has about 25,000, on average, 25,000 connections with other nerve cells. So just imagine what a phenomenal level of, you know, relating power that gives the brain. It is really extraordinary. It is a most wonderful instrument. And even learning this much, I think learning something about the insides of this computer that we take so much for granted, and maybe, you know, hammer before gyan, hammer with drugs and alcohol and other things. It's, you know, it's such a fantastic instrument. We really need to treat it with enormous care, and a sense of wonder. But some of the things that they've been learning about how this brain operates they give a kind of another angle on the way we approach our BK life. For example, the scientists have found that one group of neurons in this right lobe, behind the forehead on the right, there's a small group of neurons there that are very clearly associated with negative feeling. When you are deeply distressed, over a period of time, these neurons seem to grow in number, and certainly they grow in activity. They become more ready to fire up, and they make more connections with other parts of the brain. So actually, the way you use your brain habitually alters the readiness to experience certain types of feeling. So there is a parallel center on the left-hand side, which is more specialized with positive feeling. And the scientists who've been working with these particular brain areas have been able to show that when they took a group of people working for a biotechnology company in California, who were feeling pretty negative about their employment, as a matter of fact, the management had expressed concern about low morale in the place, and they taught them Buddhist mindfulness meditation, a particular form of meditation known as mindful meditation, which is to do with being more in control of one's thoughts, thinking more about quiet peacefulness, not allowing what the Buddhists call afflictive emotions to start running inside the brain. Over a period of eight weeks, they found that there was a noticeable shift in the activity of this lobe towards an increased activity. Normally, the scientists say there's a sort of bell-shaped distribution, that some people are out this way, some out that way, but most sit around the middle. Well, these scientists definitely move in a pronounced way towards more activity here and less here. So they were happy to show this, and it actually created world headlines. Of course, it's, you know, to us, it's, in a sense, it's something we already know, and we would think of it in terms of our sanskars and how the actual sanskars within the soul change. That's taking it to a deeper level than the scientists have reached as yet. But even understanding that simply taking care not to let negative thoughts start running, because that is going to increase the liability of this part of the brain to fire up in future, and instead to pay careful attention to allowing more positive feelings to be generated, because equally that will make it more likely that we can react positively to the things that come up. Even this discovery is quite new to many people, and I think even for BKs, it drives home the tremendous importance of what Baba has always emphasized to us, to embrace the positive, not to allow ourselves to think negatively about ourselves or about anyone else. That's why his message always to us is so positive. And of course, he gives us the context in which we can do that realistically, not just to go on some cloud cuckoo land of thinking positively, but not really dealing with the problems that are in front of us. He gives us his beautiful knowledge that although there are negative aspects of our behavior and understanding at this moment, that's because we're at the end of the cycle, and that the original state of the soul was that pure and positive, positively wired up self. So some things like this I've found useful. Other things from the neuroscientists have included things like they've discovered the phenomenal capacity that the brain, let's put it, the brain reflects, because it's really the soul that is doing all of this. But they because they can't see the soul, but their instruments can see what's happening in the brain, then it's like scientific confirmation again of soul activity, as Baba has described it to us. And another of the interesting areas is the tremendous capacity we have for, in fact, a great need for filling in any gaps in our cognition of the world, our understanding of the world. If something, we need a workable story, it seems, as human beings, all the time. And if something's missing in that, we'll fill it in. Sometimes, quite wrongly. And this is actually, you know, we're talking here about a mechanism very much associated with Maya, and how illusory ideas can become very firmly rooted inside us. There are some simple examples of this. One of the first times I heard about this as a medical writer was Jack Lemmon, the actor. I was writing about Alzheimer's disease, and Jack Lemmon is president of the American Alzheimer's Disease Association because his wife's mother was sick with Alzheimer's. You know, Alzheimer's is a disease of brain degeneration. And he was over in London, and I went to speak to him, just had snatched a half hour with him one day, and he told me this story of how his wife's mother seemed sensible in most ways, but their first indications that something was amiss was when she would sometimes get really quite paranoid with them, with those living with them, with her. He said, for example, she would suddenly start accusing us of having hidden the front door keys, hidden them away from her. And he explained that it was because, as her brain mechanisms were fading through this disease, if she left the front door keys on the kitchen table, certain times her brain wouldn't register that action. So when she comes to think about where she left the front door keys, her brain did register it, perhaps, the previous time when she put them in a drawer. But so she goes and looks in the drawer for those keys, but then I should tell it the other way around, actually, because it would be obvious if they were on the table but not in the drawer. But let's say this time she'd put them in the drawer, but the previous time she left them on the table. Then they're not on the table. And the only explanation she can give for the disappearance from the table, when she knows, because her brain's telling her, that was where she put them the last time she came in. The only explanation is someone's hiding them from her. Someone wants to drive me mad. It's like you create a story to fill in these gaps. And this, of course, is Maya. Daddy Jank is often given classes on imagination and how often we suffer from these imagined wrongs done to us, which are the only way we can sort of fill in a story about our perception of things. Another example of this mechanism, which I found very interesting, was a chap who became convinced that his mother was an imposter, pretending to be his mother. And he grew hugely angry about this when she came into his presence. And, you know, it was a really serious matter. And the brain scientists found that a circuit that connects this individual's, should normally connect this individual's visual recognition neurons, because, you know, the brain is very, very detailed and specific in the way it handles functions. There are groups of neurons that are concerned specifically with recognizing faces, and the connection between that and a feeling center, because all the time our brain is attaching feelings to objects and experiences, so that we're not just a computer. You know, the way we experience the world gets written into the brain. So that connection had been broken by a small stroke that this chap had suffered, and because of that, he saw his mother. To all intents and purposes, this was his mother. He recognized her, but there was no feeling of his mother attached to her. And so his only explanation for this was, she's an imposter. And he was absolutely convinced of it. If he heard his mother on the telephone, because his auditory connections to his feeling centers were still intact, he would say, "Mum, where have you been? There's this dreadful person pretending to be you who keeps tormenting me." And these kind of insights, when something goes wrong inside the brain, actually, very often, it's these insights that the neurologists are working with to give us some ideas about, you know, build up more and more of a picture of the way the brain functions. That leads me to mention, just finally in this area of neuroscience, there's one other quite amusing thing I'd like to share with you, actually, that sometimes there are groups of neurons associated with separate functions, but they lie in adjacent areas within the brain. And the whole thing actually is a sort of shimmering sense of connectivity. Sometimes these wirings can be, to the individual actually, they may not be at all discomforting, but it's quite common for people to get cross connections that mix things up in a sensory way, so that there was one individual who, when he heard words, he smells them. I heard this person interviewed on the radio in connection with a lecture on neuroscience, and the interviewer said, "Could you give me an example?" And he said, "Yes, example, baked beans." Immediately he heard the word example, he could smell baked beans. And I forget whether it was smell or taste. Anyway, it was this crossover from words. And there was a range of them like this. You know, Lucozade came up for a particular set of ideas that she put to him. It was quite fascinating. And clearly these kind of cross connections are actually very common and may lie behind our fabulous human capacity to see symbolism, to create with the arts, you know, to see one thing and be reminded of something else. It's part of the rich human experience that we have. And it's a soul capacity, but it's mediated by this magnificent brain. So these are a few very interesting findings that I think are pointing us towards understanding the importance of the way that we actually start to use our brains. Because perhaps the most important finding to emerge from modern neuroscience is this one, that the brain is not just a computer. It isn't just an information processing thing like, you know, a microprocessor. Everything, but almost everything perhaps, has feeling attached to it. Probably everything. So, in fact, there's a book by a neurologist called the subtitle is The Feeling Brain. Joy, Sorrow, and the Feeling Brain. And it's all to do with how feelings arise inside us absolutely as part of the soul's relating to the world around. The feelings are there to give us fine-tuning adjustments. You know, am I, as an organism, functioning in harmony with my environment? If I am, I will feel good. If I'm not, there'll be signals to me that will come in the form of negative feelings that don't go down that route, you know. And our problem is that sometimes we become, partly because of our own complexity, but particularly because of the cumulative effect of sanskars, as Baba has explained it, we have moved further and further away from receiving accurately the signals around us about what is going on in the world around us. There are so many affective emotions, to use that Buddhist term, by which they mean they're emotions that are like diseases, that are not appropriate, but which fire up so easily. You know, like I've had a bad experience with a dog, and I see a dog 100 yards from me, and I feel great fear. That's an afflictive emotion arising from past experience getting wired into me in that way. With Baba's knowledge about the sanskars, we can see that it's not only the experiences of this birth that we may carry inappropriate responses, but also experiences of our many births of behaving in ways that are not in line with how nature intended us to behave. These two will afflict us as we move through life. It's a very fascinating field. This idea that actually within us, hardwired into us, are both useful connections, but also inappropriate connections, I find also helpful to me in understanding why Baba tells us that we should make the core of our practice the relationship with him through a bodiless awareness. Because if you think that this, imagine that most of this brain has got wired up in many ways with responses that are not accurate. You see somebody, and because of a past reaction to them, because of past argument with them, might be someone close to you, might be someone unknown to you, but just something about the way they behave, and you start reacting inside. Feelings of a negative kind become associated with your responses. That completely clouds your ability to see the situation clearly and to act appropriately. This is Maya. And we're all afflicted by it. And it's not just a question of the Maya within the soul. It's actually reflected, you see, in the functioning of this instrument that we have. But when you understand that it's actually that in some ways, especially in adults, these inappropriate responses will actually have been set in place in your brain, it helps you to see, as I say, that sometimes the only way of overcoming a negative predisposition, a negative sanskar, a negative hardwiring, if you like, reflecting that sanskar, the only and most important way of overcoming that will be to disengage from the wiring in these parts of the brain and go to the point through which you can connect to God. I have found this a very powerful method that has actually helped me in my Brahmin life over this last couple of years quite considerably. That I know that we've often said, of course, it's classic teaching to come into the awareness of the self as this point of light, and that we, through that point, when we move into that awareness, we connect to Baba. But somehow, knowing the reasoning behind this, for someone like Sister Genty, who makes this the centerpiece of her meditation, always, when anyone has any problems, she brings them back to that pointed self-awareness as a means of quietening these other circuits that have started to get activated and bringing them into a place where they are actually in, again, what the neuroscientists call the God spot. You know that they've found that there is a place here behind the center of the forehead, a brain area, which when stimulated produces visionary experiences, feelings of oneness, of self-transcendence, many things that are associated with core and most positive religious experience. And again, when these findings were first reported, those who would like to believe that all that there is in the world is a materialistic explanation said, ah, there we are, we've explained God, or we've explained the soul, or whatever. But in fact, the scientists who've done this work themselves say, no, we haven't done that at all. They say, very accurately, that yes, there is a mechanism, a brain mechanism, whose activation is associated with feelings of self-transcendence, of love for something beyond the self. That doesn't mean to say that that beyond doesn't exist. Nature has provided us with the means for perceiving every different aspect of reality. Just because I have certain, let's say, the divine, it doesn't mean that the divine doesn't exist. But it's important to understand that there's this mirroring of the divine in the material. And I think this is exciting and important because it's actually taking the scientists more and more, as they go in more detailed understanding of this material mirror, maybe the time will come where they'll see, well, what is being reflected? We can't find it anywhere in the brain. We can see its impact on the brain, but it's coming from somewhere. And that will ultimately, I hope and I believe, take them towards that source, which is Baba and the divine dimension of reality. So in this extraordinary variety of ways, we're moving in this confluence age towards a confluence not only of material understanding, but a confluence between the material and the spiritual. A few words now about what I mentioned earlier, that I think an aspect that goes deeper than these neuroscientific findings, even though I do consider them important because of the way they're pushing scientists towards understanding that there is this other dimension. In the, this was about 1997, Stella, was it? The last of the series of science and consciousness conferences, when 99, as recent as that, was it? Right. At the last of this series that was held, and it took place in Olympia in Greece, we brought together a number of scientists working with what is known as the consciousness-based paradigm. And I'll tell you a little bit about this. In effect, it reverses the materialistic paradigm which orthodox science works with. You know, orthodox science, probably most of you are familiar with the basic story that science tells us, which is of a Big Bang, billions of years ago, of matter, gases gradually coalescing, eventually the formation of galaxies, of stars, of planets, eventually the formation of a planet like the Earth, favorable to the development of life, and over millions of years, gradually the formation of more complex molecules, until eventually those molecules, you know, through the primeval soup, some bolt of lightning, or, you know, some special circumstances, and life in a simple form starts to develop. You get self-replicating molecules, and they become more complex, and they come out onto the land, and you get cells forming, and they become more complex, and you get brains, and you get a mind at the end of all that. So consciousness is seen as the end result of billions of years of material evolution in the conventional culture. Mind and consciousness is seen in that light. Something that has come arising out of material complexity. That's the conventional view. That is turned completely on its head by this new paradigm, which comes from primarily from physicists working in the area of quantum physics, quantum theory. And I can only give you the briefest flavor of their thinking, because it's not complicated, but it's so unfamiliar. Even for BKs, you know, most BKs are exposed all the time from their schooling, from what we read in the newspapers or hear on the radio, to this basic materialistic paradigm, even though we know we're working with spiritual understanding. And yet, you know, our worldview very often is still behind what we may consciously be doing, dictated by this materialistic paradigm. But These chaps are working with something quite different. I'll just give you a flavour of it. Quantum theory is the name given to a branch of physics that took off or began to be established about 100 years ago. It gets its name from an observation that certain physical phenomena come in discrete units, quanta. One of the original observations that it all came from, apparently, was a scientist was watching heat from a radiant source, a fire, and was struck by the fact that first you have red coals, and then you know, after a certain temperature increase, you get a different colour. You may eventually get a white hot. I think it may go through blue, and then to white. And they were struck by the fact that it wasn't a continuous movement from red to reddish to reddish blue to white, but that it would go in a quite distinct jump, you know, beyond a certain temperature, it would jump to a different, actually it's a wavelength of the radiant heat. And this observation, that's how quantum theory gets its name, because it later became discovered that at the very fundamental level, matter the components of matter, such as electrons, subatomic particles, that these behave in ways that at times are very unpredictable and very, well, at least by conventional thinking. They didn't fall in line with the old billiard ball action and reaction physics that Isaac Newton had developed and that had ruled physics for a couple of hundred years. So the in a nutshell, what the quantum theorists have found that is most remarkable is that at this very fundamental level, inside the atom, the particles there don't behave all the time like matter. In fact, there is a stage where they are non-material. They are more like ideas. It's quite remarkable that this is the case, but it's a fact. The best way of understanding it, as I saw it described by a Professor Goswami, who's written a number of books on the implications of quantum theory. He's based at the University of Oregon in the US. He says how in the hydrogen atom, for example, which has just, it's a very simple atom that has a nucleus and a single electron. And at one time it was thought that the electron orbited the nucleus of the atom, you know, like the Earth orbiting the Sun. But the quantum theorists found that actually that wasn't an accurate description, that you couldn't say that it goes like that. But more, the understanding that they've come to is that that electron occupies the whole of an area of space around the nucleus, which is defined as a cloud of possibility. It's described very accurately by the quantum equations. The equation concerned is called a wave function. And the wave function will tell you that there's a high probability that if you go in and look for the electron, you'll find it in a particular areas. Less probability further out, less probability further in. And there's an actual wave-like distribution of the probability of where you'll find it if you go and look for it. But this is where it gets more interesting still. That electron, it's in this wave-like form where it's like everywhere and nowhere, but very law-like. If you do thousands of observations, it will exactly fit the distribution described by the maths. The electron only comes into being when a conscious observer looks for it. You, the scientist, actually bring that electron into being as a particle. This is a fact. You might think that supposing you put your observing instrument in to look for the electron, but you don't actually look down the observing instrument. What happens then? It will remain as that cloud of possibility. You could put another observing instrument to observe the first. You could have a whole series of them. They all become part of this quantum system, which is like in the area of probabilities, described by the maths very accurately, but not existing as a particle. And it only becomes a particle when a conscious observer comes and looks for it. So that act of looking brings it into being. The Call of the Times theme, in fact, was seeing into being. The Call of the Time retreat that was held here recently at Gyantsarova theme was seeing into being, and it's partly a development of these very basic understandings from quantum theory. It's taught scientists that there is no such thing as a completely objective view of the world. We are actually creating the world by our observations. Consciousness is actually bringing the world into being, shaping the world all the time by the way it functions. And again, when we bring this home deeply into our hearts, we understand what a huge responsibility it is to make sure that our consciousness is as positive as is possible and appropriate. Because that's going to be the kind of world that we create. I've made quite a quantum leap myself there, from introducing you to this concept from quantum theory to what we know more about the spiritual side. But just to stick for a moment longer with that quantum level. It was apparent to the quantum theorists as far back as the 1930s that something very mysterious was going on here, that there was some element to reality that was quite outside the conventional materialistic view of the world. Maybe I've jumped the gun a bit, so I'll carry on till it starts. Back in the 30s, the scientists had recognized that these findings meant that our view of the world was profoundly challenged and should be, but the world of science is as human as any other, and the real implications of these discoveries haven't been taken on board and started to be developed until quite recently with a series of books and articles by physicists and others who are facing up to the implications of this discovery. The core thing is that they're being pointed to, again, towards the understanding that the missing dimension for science is the soul dimension, is consciousness. There is this aspect of reality that Baba has put absolutely central for us, so liberatingly, so illuminatingly, which is missing from science. But it's the fact that there is a move towards the recognition of this. You see, what the theorists who have understood the importance of this act of consciousness in bringing into being that electron as a particle, as opposed to this cloud of possibility, they argue that since not just that particular hydrogen atom, but the entire physical world is ultimately made up of these subatomic particles, then ultimately the entire physical world requires consciousness to bring it into being, to shape it, to make it. Wonderful, wonderful insight into the interplay between consciousness and matter. At least, you know, a huge step forward towards understanding the importance of that interplay, which until now has been missing from science. So some very encouraging developments of this kind. And I'll just conclude on these little snatches from positive developments in science, in the area of consciousness, with an anecdote that came also from that last Science and Consciousness Symposium. I was sitting next to one of the professors from the States, who's a professor of interdisciplinary sciences at one of the universities and in charge of an Earth-observing laboratory there. Very... This professor's name is Menas Kefatos, and very distinguished chap, author of a book called The Conscious Universe, based on his interpretation and understanding of quantum theory and written with a mathematician. The question that I asked him as we were traveling back on a coach from Olympia to Athens was, Professor Kefatos, this conference has shown us that there is a new paradigm being developed within science, arising from quantum theory, within which many of the revealed pieces of information that we work with in the Brahma Kumaris, to do with the spiritual nature of the world, of ourselves and the world, much of this is much easier to fit into this kind of picture that science is developing than the materialistic model. However, in one area, which we hadn't raised at this conference, I said to him, there's still a big gap seems to remain, and that is that it was part of the information that came through at the founding of the Spiritual University, that we exist in a cycle of time that has a very fixed dimension of 5,000 years, repeating eternally. And I said there's a big gap between 5,000 years and 16 billion years, which is the conventional scientific view current, or that can change by a few billion years fairly regularly, actually, of the age of the universe. And I said, do you think that gap will ever be closed? And, you know, it made my heart really happy when he said, no problem. Really, those were his words. And he explained that it's not that he's saying that science is proving the 5,000-year cycle, but this different way of thinking allows one to understand that many of the observations that science has made, and on which basis this story of 16 billion years has been developed, were made with the omission of this vital factor of consciousness. If consciousness is not seen as part of the picture, as an organizing, influencing element in the way, you know, souls and matter interact, if that's right out of the picture, then the only explanation you can reach for various phenomena that are existing around us is that they've developed over all these billions of years. Because it's taken that kind of time, even then, some scientists say, it's extraordinarily unlikely that the right set of circumstances would have come about to have produced something as complex even as an amoeba, let alone the human being. But still, it is those billions of years that are part of that story that has consciousness missing. But when you bring consciousness into the picture and you understand the importance of this dimension of being, which these scientists working with the consciousness-based paradigm are putting as so important, then the story becomes much simpler. What he was explaining was, the image he used was rather like Shakespeare might work out in his mind the whole of Macbeth, one of his plays, so that the whole of what then later appears on the stage is actually put together, evolved and put together at a mental level, but it's outside of time. It's like at a subtle level. I mean, Babarik has explained very clearly that actually the drama we are in is eternal, and it hasn't actually required someone to put it together from scratch. But nevertheless, he's also very clear that there is a movement behind it. There's a script of the drama that ensures that everything happens in place at the right time in the right way. And that script is what the scientists are seeing as, you know, as a conscient element, purpose, behind the way the matter moves. This is dramatically different from the conventional scientific view that things have come about through chance development over billions of years. So it's introducing the element of purpose, of a scripted drama, as opposed to something that is just happening by blind chance until it happens to work out that life exists. This is what makes it possible to reduce from 16 billion years to something that might just be the simple duration of the play. Because all the putting together, it actually doesn't have to happen at this physical level. It's there as a kind of, as Babas explained it very clearly, a film. It's there that gets projected down here into this physical realm, and then consciousness, souls, experience it frame by frame, just as if we're watching a film. And so the scientists are actually getting very close to moving towards, at least, an understanding that brings them much closer to where Baba has explained the reality lies on this. Intuitively, for me, the concept of the cycle has been no problem now for a long time. I found it far and away the most satisfying internal explanation of things. But still, it makes my heart and intellect happy that these other guys are beginning to move towards an explanation in scientific terms. There's lots of these little developments that are pointing in the same direction, but I've just given you an overview. As I mentioned, really it's not necessary to have to study or to have any understanding of these things, but it's nice to know that they're there, so that sometimes when scientifically oriented people say, But science has proved that you know, the world is billions of years old and not 5,000 years. You can know that that is not actually the case. That's a story from science, which has a certain beauty and elegance to it, but there's another story developing. And so no need to argue about these things, and no need even to put your heads into them. But if you are that way inclined, you may like to know that these developments are occurring. I wonder if any of you have got any questions arising from that before I ask Stella to come and share something of her experience. Is that broadly okay, what I've set out? Got a rough feeling for the way things are moving? Anything, any specific question you'd like to ask? Good, you've got the whole of the last 100 years of scientific development firmly in your heads. You can by all means send me an email and I can send you some references relating to these issues. There's a lot happening now. Of course it will be resisted. We're all resistant to our ideas being changed. That's part of the human condition. Al? No, not that I know of. You mean in relation to positive and negative? No. Of course there are many other differences that are gender specific. There are many other functions, definitely, but where they've shown very clearly that according to exposure to certain hormones and genetic activity in the womb, depending on whether it's a male or female fetus, the brain gets wired up differently. Absolutely. There's lots and lots of evidence of this now. Again, to me, it shows the importance of transcending our brain functioning and moving into the awareness of the self as that bodiless entity. Because when we do that, we can connect to Baba's pure consciousness. But as long as we're trapped in brain functioning, in the body and the brain functioning, we're going to be subject to these illusory circuits. That's why it's so important to develop the bodiless stage again and again and again. That's how we can bring truth inside ourselves and transcend these illusions that Maya has made us afflicted with. That's the take-home message for me, really. Along with the importance of the fact that we see things into being, we think them into being. This Antonio Damasio, the neurologist I mentioned earlier, he quotes a couple of lines from The King and I, that Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, which contains the Whistle a Happy Tune song. And it's when Anna, who is the governess, I think, and she's very nervous about going before the king, but she tells the king's son and herself that if we think, you know, in a joyful way, that will actually make us feel joyful. And again, so much evidence emerging about this, how emotions give rise to feelings. Emotions, as the neurologists understand them, are more physical goings on in the body. There are specific neurons in the brain stem, the little groups of them, that will, for example, trigger scientists stimulate them, it will trigger a whole collection of physical activities related to sadness. You know, tears flowing, posture hunched, face drawn, all of these things just from this. And then when they do that, the mind creates feelings consequent upon those emotions, because the mind perceives the bodily state of sadness and then creates a feeling and thoughts associated with those feelings. So someone with their brain stimulated in this way, from having been perfectly normal, happy person, not subject to depression, when they suddenly this is triggered, they'll say, I feel useless, I'm so sad, I know I'm a burden to you all, you know. These kind of thoughts will come from nowhere. Yes, yes. But it's because the self is perceiving this emotional state and then creating a story to fit that. And then when they stop stimulating that area, within 90 seconds, what was all that about? I felt so bad for a little while, you know. It's quite astonishing how much we're subject to these brain mechanisms, which again and again, why Baba tells us, become bodiless. You know, then, so it really, in the sense, it's not just transcending the body, it's transcending the brain. So coming to that point and experience the joy of relationship with Baba and let that guide us. Let Baba's consciousness guide us. This Whistle a Happy Tune, the reason that this was mentioned, the words go like this. the results of this deception are very strange to tell when she's, you know, deceiving the king by pretending to be happy and confident. The results of this deception are very strange to tell, for when I fool the people I fear, I fool myself as well. You know, it's like that insight that when we fake it, we make it. When we pretend to be happy, we'll become happy. When we adopt the emotion of happiness, like the Dalias are always telling us to, we'll actually develop thoughts and feelings associated with those emotions. So again, you know, another nice coming together between neuroscience and the insights that have come from God. Any other questions? Okay, then I'd like to invite Stella to come and meet you. She's a remarkable story to tell, and it'd be lovely to hear from the big companion who came along.
So I took all the papers down, all these bags down, and I started to light them. And if any of you tried to burn papers, it's not that you think it'd be easy, but it's actually not very easy to burn papers. They kind of get stuck and they don't want to burn. And I heard some splashing behind me, and splashing, splashing. And I'm not very, I don't pay attention to sound so much. And I ignored it, and I could sort of hear it. And it kept on and on. And I finally said, what is that? And I turn around, and maybe from here to the where the back wall is, there was this enormous whale. I mean, a really big whale. This was not a little one. It was right by, as close as it could possibly get to the shoreline without actually going on the shore. And I thought, my God, what is this animal doing here? This is amazing. And my first thought was, oh, I'll go and phone somebody I'd been recently talking to and saying, there's a whale here. How exciting this is. And then there was a very, very strong voice inside that says, no, this is for you. Just enjoy this. And I just calmed down, and I looked at this whale, and it was very peacefully sort of just there in the water and almost like communing with me. And it gave me a sense of peace that I hadn't had previously. Everything just calmed down, and I looked at it. I was there for such a long time, I went back to my paper burning. Eventually, it swam away, and the paper burning, you know, continued and was fine. And then maybe 2-3 days later, I'm speaking to a friend of mine, and he said, who was not a Brahmin, he said, well, let me look up what the Native American Indians consider the whale medicine to be. What is the energy or the power that the whale brings to you? Just like they see other animals have certain, what they call medicine, which is, I guess, a gift of healing. And so he looks it up in his book, and I still can't believe this, actually. He says, the whale is the cosmic record keeper. And it was as if the whale was saying to me, and he said this to me, and I was going, yeah, that's right. The whale said, all the records are being kept for you. You do not have to keep any records. When you need something, it will be provided for you. Now, of course, this is such a deep lesson for all of us that when we need, we don't have to worry about anything. We don't have to keep things. We can let them go because at each moment, according to synchronicity, according to the magic of the drama, according to our consciousness, of our role and our task and our karma at that moment, whatever we need in order to move forward will be provided for us. And this is such a beautiful story. It was such a lovely way for drama to stamp that on the soul.
Like an affirmation. Yeah. You're on the right lines. There you go.
That's right.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, and I have many stories like that, actually. Many, many stories throughout my Brahman life. And it has been these beautiful stories like that that have like signals in the drama. I mean, we must all have them. You know, there's something that only you will know the significance of. And it comes at just the right time, and it says you're on track. It's as if I see it really as that once we trust Baba, and once we trust drama, and once we trust ourselves, that we know how to control the universe, as scientists are trying to do by understanding the outer world. We know that by controlling the inner world, we actually control the outer world. So Baba is teaching us those scientific principles, or those principles of knowledge, because science originally was knowledge. It's become a Kali Yugi in its form now, but originally it was knowledge. So Baba is teaching us those principles of knowledge that allow us to be the master creators, the creators of our reality. So then we know that everything is going to be good. And we know that what we want to achieve in terms of the inner feeling of what we want, you know, we want to feel loving, or we want to feel happy, or we want something to happen, and we might have a physical form on how it's going to take place. But the drama says you can have what you truly need, that's the feeling, but the form is always some kind of a surprise. It never quite comes in the way that you think it's going to come. And so it becomes like a magical mystery tour in which you go from signal to say you're still on track, keep going, and just keep on refining the intellect, refining the understanding of these spiritual laws and spiritual principles which actually create our physical reality.
Stella, you said also when we were chatting earlier that you'd never felt that yourself to be a scientist, even though you did excel in your field, but that you felt that there was something intrinsically sorrowful or sorrow-making about the scientific process. Could you say a word about that?
I certainly did. My family on both sides came from losing their physical belongings, their social position, their community, their family from communism independently. So there was a really deep commitment in my family heritage to getting well educated, because my father very explicitly kept telling me, the only thing you can ever count on and take with you in a moment's notice, because that's what happens, a knock on the door and you have to run, it happened to both sides of the family, with nothing, is what you have in your head. So the biggest gift I can give you is to educate you so that you are ready to be able to live anywhere, to always be able to support yourself, and to be self-sufficient. Now, those are very laudable aims, but in reality, what happened was that my father believed that the only universal knowledge was that of science and mathematics. We can understand that if you don't have gyan, but this wasn't something that was comfortable for the soul, because... So I was more or less forced, if you like, to take up science, and I was very good at it, so that I continued in it to PhD level and beyond. But from the very first day of entering the university in the sciences, sorrowfully, I could see, I literally remember, this is a literal story of my first year lab assistant tutor walking past in her lab coat with a whole tray of little test tubes, very, very purposefully from one side of the corridor, and I was sitting there and I thought, I could tell, the soul knew, she doesn't know what she's doing. I mean, she's doing a particular task, but she doesn't know why she's doing that task. Like, what is the purpose of all of this? What's the purpose of all these people in white lab coats dissecting mice? You know, it really was deeply sorrowful to me to see that. And I chose biology because it was a compromise with my father between physics and mathematics and not going into the arts, which he said, you can't earn a living in the arts. You have to do something practical. So biology, he wasn't happy with. I wasn't happy with, but we compromised because I love nature. I love the beauty of it. I love the harmony of it, because it's almost like I didn't have a religious upbringing, but to go out into the natural, beautiful environment almost felt like a spiritual experience until I found Baba, of course. But going systematically into the study and classification and dissection, analytically as well as literally. I mean, I didn't do any much physical stuff, but even the analysis of how the physical universe works, that whole culture and the dryness of that approach was so debilitating for the soul. It was such a denial of feelings of, even feelings of beauty and feelings of sharing with other people. It was quite competitive. It was dry, very, very dry. And I really did suffer a lot in that whole process. It was a very difficult process. And sort of later on in my career, I found that through language, because I was working in the field of environment, and a lot of the arguments for protecting a particular species or protecting a particular area were to do with people's feelings. They want to have natural woods instead of a highway. They want to protect the habitat of a koala bear, even though a koala bear has no economic significance. So you're having to create arguments on the basis of some kind of fact, but they don't relate into the reality of people's feelings about things and their innate right to having a natural environment surrounding them. So it took me, this is a personal journey of mine, through the vehicle of language to begin to use words which were actually not strictly objective, but they had qualities in them like it is, I can't think of a word now, but it is, you know, the aesthetics of this place is something that is deeply important to people. You know, I would say words like that. And but I found it extremely challenging to do that because the community doesn't want that. They just want the facts, and you can't make the argument on the basis of numbers. And that's where abstraction of reality into numbers became a way, it's almost like became an anathema to the soul. And at that time I didn't know Baba, so it was a real extremely painful and difficult process for me until I met Baba. It still continued to be painful, but I gradually worked my way out. But I feel that the scientific paradigm, which is a creation of the soul, it's a creation of the soul. It doesn't stand outside of the human soul. There's no reality in it any more than there is in anything else. It's simply a process which we give a lot of power to. It actually can be very destructive to our innate nature.
How have you overcome that sense of hurt to your own being that those years working as a scientist? Yeah. Is that too long a story, or is that is it just a healing that has taken place through relationship with Baba?
It's basically a healing that's taken place through a relationship with Baba.
It's simple, really.
Really is. It's not a specific way. And I've had to... I mean, a lot of it has been I would be writing something that I've been asked to write, and I could see the anger that was in my own writing, even around the protection of something or the philosophical arguments for not doing things a particular way. And then looking at that, I could see, you know, I'm projecting out onto these people something that really is my concern. So instead of, you know, Baba talks about don't look at another person. That person is an instrument for you to learn about yourself. It's, you know, they may or may not be right. It's really not your concern. You have to look at your own sanskaras. So I was starting to look at the whole scientific community. So I had a sort of a collective, if you like, enemy. And I started to see that my dislike of them or my, fear of them, because in other part of the scientific culture, it's very critical. You know that it's based in criticism. You're looking at someone and seeing whether you can find fault in their thinking. I had to see where I was doing that. I had to see where I was not being compassionate. So I did it in the way that anyone else would do it with a human being. I did it with the whole scientific community.
Mm. Mm. Well, I want to ask a question of Stella before we close.
Should we have 1 minute of silence?